Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. And as we approach the beginnings of these trials around the death of Freddie Gray, the officers accused, we'll have this continuing commentary here on this program about this, starting with the trials coming up November 30th. Juries will be picked, and Officer Porter is the first case up. And it's really an interesting phenomenon. And so, as usual, we have on our program A. Dwight Pettit, Dwight Pettit being one of our leading attorneys in criminal justice, criminal attorneys here in the city of Baltimore, representing clients in lawsuits against police for many years, and joins us here in the studio right now. So welcome. Good to see you, Dwight.
Glad to be here, Mark. Thanks for having me.
So there's a lot of questions to ask, but you're watching these cases very closely. And talk, first of all, as a person who's had many cases like this, watch how the courts work. What do you think about the case right now against the state has brought against Officer Porter?
Well, I think it's a very reasonable case. It's a case with a different standard than a lot of times we're thinking about. When you see hear the name or you hear the words murder in the second degree, you think about intent, you think about malice, you think about a forethought. And those things are not required here. This is Braveheart murder. And basically that's involved with a gross negligence type of standard, a condition that you observed and you helped create, and you allowed the deceased to be subject to those conditions which you were aware of. That's almost the same thing, Mark, if I may, in terms of the manslaughter charges, and also a similar basis in terms of the reckless endangerment. So there is it's not the higher standard that the public generally thinks about that the state has to make here. The state basically has to, in fact, prove those elements of gross negligence and extreme dangerous condition, which they believe that they have in some of the statements that Porter, who's going to trial first, made to both Goodson as well as White. And so that's the basis of the what they knew and what they should have done or didn't do.
Now, how about the legal minds who would argue that makes for a very tough case to convict because it can be so amorphous?
Well, it's a tough case. This is by no means a slam dunk. The question is whether they're going to be able to get some convictions on something, potentially a misconduct in office and probably reckless endangerment, whether they can get the higher counts of manslaughter or depraved heart murder is going to be very, very difficult. So they have a rough road. The prosecution has a rough road.
And I've never heard – I mean, as we talked about in the show a couple of months back, this is the first time I've ever heard of somebody being charged with depraved –
it's an old common law.
It's old.
Mm-hmm. And it's the statute in which he was, in fact, or of which Goodson was charged under, because Goodson is the driver of the van.
Right. Goodson was the driver of the van. Mm-hmm. So what about not having the jury sequestered, but having them not having their names released? What is the
effect? Well, you've got to remember the whole motion for sequestration was a backdoor attempt to revive the change of venue. That's all that was. In other words, to make it more difficult to pick a jury, because the magic words in picking a jury is, can you listen to the evidence that's produced in the courtroom and reach an unbiased and fair decision? Once the jury answers that in the affirmative, and they've already gone through whether you believe the police or don't believe the police, well, that qualifies you to be a jury. So by asking for sequestration, what they were doing was, in fact, making it more difficult to pick a jury, because most people were going to try to opt out by saying, you know, I can't be away from my family for a month or for 6 weeks locked in a hotel. And so that was going to increase the difficulties of picking a jury. And since Judge Williams said it was a continuing issue that he would revisit at certain times, the argument was going to be made with sequestration, it's impossible to pick a jury in Baltimore City. So he basically kicked that argument out by not reviewing and denying the motion for change of venue. And he also basically kicked that out by denying the sequestration. But the anonymity is good because it protects the juror from being harassed, from being prejudiced by information, by being harassed by press or any other forces that could, in fact, distract them from what they hear in the courtroom.
So the press is going to be there so they can physically see who the jury is.
But they're going to be very, very limited as to what they have in terms of information as to who those jurors are.
So I'm just a little – if you have a question, please jump in before I go to the phone so you get some other questions from the audience. But I wonder how that works because when you have the voir dire, the process to choose the jury – that's public, right?
No, that's he can make that restrictive to the lawyers.
Okay, I see. Gotcha.
Right. And in many cases when we have trials, both civil and criminal, the we have now, as a matter of rule of court, we have to turn those jury lists right back in immediately. And we cannot keep those and we cannot disclose what's the information that's provided to us for jury selection and voir dire.
Let me open the phones here. Let folks have that, and please, Jeff, have that as well. 410-319-8888. Bill, welcome. You're on the air.
Yes, first of all, let me just say thank you to Mark, and how are you doing tomorrow?
I'm good. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm good. My question is this. I've raised this before, but I never really got the answer. What is Nick Mosby Cassidy going to do in terms of playing a case for the defense as these cases go forward? Because in my mind, it just don't make no sense that he would run for mayor when his wife has something like this up against her. So I'm just trying to, figure out why would he run and what effect would this have in terms of these cases?
I'm not sure.
Well, the political question is running because he wants to be mayor of Baltimore. I think that there's an argument to be made whether or not people have their own opinions about the fact that he's married to Marilyn Mosby. But I
missed the question, but that's what it was.
And I don't think it has much effect or impact on this case or the jury.
No, that should be a totally separate type of thing. I guess the only thing that it does in terms of her being on center stage is perpetuate the familiarity with his name and who he is and what have you. Now, maybe he's looking for some bleed over. Because she's got tremendous political capital and support in the community for this case. I think she does. And maybe he's looking for that to bleed over in terms of his run for mayor. That's the only thing I can say.
Yeah. Do you have a question, Jeff?
I do. I do. For our counselor, talk about the defense. And, for example, the character witnesses, 25 or however many character witnesses, would that be dispositive in any way?
Well, no. The character witnesses are going to be very limited for several reasons. And now that's some good defenses now. So that's a very broad question, Jeff. The character witnesses are limited because you can have character witnesses for two things. One, your reputation for peace and goodwill and so forth in the community. Well, these are not crimes of violence. This is gross negligence. That's why the argument was to exclude or limit those type of character witnesses. The other standard is your reputation for truth and veracity. And that's what the judge is saying. You can have some, but you are limited even on that aspect. But this is not a crime of violence and so forth where you have to talk about peace and goodwill and whatever. It's a crime of gross negligence and neglect and failure to, in fact, act. Now, there are many, many good – this is, as I said, this is not a slam dunk. And part of the defense is going to be where did the injury occur? I'm very interested in what the pathological or the pathology testimony is going to be in terms of where the death occurred. Mm. I mean, the conclusion that, as I heard initially, that it dealt with the fact of the impact, a tremendous impact in the van. Well, there's a lot of information as to whether the injury occurred before he's in the van, when you look at his condition and what have you. And so that's going to be, if I'm on the defense side, I'm banging away at that in terms of the arguments in terms of reasonable doubt. Also, you got to remember when Porter makes the statement to Goodson and to White that Gray needs medical attention and what have you. He also does a double-edged sword by saying it might be just a ruse because he doesn't want to go to jail. And so they're going to have that's two statements that are made and can be taken both ways. One way can be taken by the defense to say he didn't really give them proper notice of the injury because it wasn't, he's saying it's not believable in his experiences with Gray in the past that this might have been just Gray acting. And so you didn't really, they didn't really have concrete information of his condition. So that's going to go both ways. So there's plenty of error opportunity here for arguments for reasonable doubt. And, you know, so it's a textbook trial.
Interesting. 410-319-8888. Terry, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning, Terry.
Terry.
Yes, I was calling because I actually served on a jury. It was shaken baby syndrome, and not shaken baby. You're right. When the baby is shaken, and one of the charges was second degree depraved heart murder. Now, my question is, the jury, we had difficulty in truly understanding that charge, and it ended up in a hung jury as a result. My question is, I can't recall what kind of, they gave us instructions, but I think we needed more of an education. And so will the jurors get some sort of training, or I guess training is the wrong word, but that charge is kind of difficult to understand, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, that's going to rest with the judge making the charges to the jury. Instructions, it's called. He'd be given the jury instructions as to what the law is, and because that's binding. And then it will be up to plaintiff's counsel. I mean, not plaintiff, strike that. It will be up to the state's attorney and defense counsel to, in fact, dissect that charge in the light most favorable to their position and to their clients.
One of the things here that was raised in some articles, that Williams has ruled that prosecutors the jury will not be able to hear the prosecutor's claim that the arrest was done without probable cause. They'll also be allowed to see two citizen shot videos of the arrest and another stop by the police transport van and look at the van, but will not allow anything about Gray's past coming in as irrelevant. So what all these decisions mean?
Well, he's going both ways, but I think these decisions are right now in favor of the state. In terms of, these are some very, very difficult rulings. Now, let's back up for a second, because you got to remember, in this case, a lot of discussion was done by what they call probable cause and reasonable suspicion. And that goes into whether or not the Wardlow case that a lot of people are talking about, Wardlow versus Illinois. When a person runs, Chief Justice Rehnquist of the Supreme Court said at the time the year 2000, that running in itself in an area with high crime rate is in fact indicative of criminal act. Well, that's sort of not particularly been followed in Maryland. Maryland almost says you've got to go back to Terry, and has to be some articulable, reasonable suspicion that this person is committing a crime. And so the state, in its wisdom, in my opinion, into these particular cases, well, it might come back in the other offices, but they sort of moved away from false imprisonment, which would get to those questions in much more detail. They dropped those charges, if you remember. By dropping the false imprisonment, in this particular case, Porter doesn't have anything to do with that anyway, because Porter is not part of the arresting team. So it's two reasons. It's taken out because of relevancy. And number two, you get to the fact of the arrest aspect, which is going to come up later. Not only the running aspect, but then you have the possibility of probable cause at the time the knife is found and whether the knife is within a Terry stop or not within a Terry stop. So to avoid all of that, what the state is saying, we're going to rid ourselves of those charges and we're going to go for the substantive issues in terms of the conviction of whether or not he was in a dire medical condition, and they knew or should have known and failed to act. And so that's getting away from the procedural issues of the constitutional issues of the arrest. But that will be revisited upon the other officers, particularly those officers that were involved in the arrest.
Now, before we have to close out this hour, Dwight, what effect can this case have on the other cases?
It's going to have a tremendous effect. First of all, we're assuming that Porter's going to go to trial. Porter still has about a week to determine whether or not he wants to take a plea.
Interesting.
And take an offer that can be made that can make him a state's witness and so forth, and his statements can come in against the others. If he goes to trial and bites the bullet and says, hey, I'm going to go to trial and take the risk for the blue badge and so forth, then if he goes down, then the other defendants are in big jeopardy because his statement can be used. He could be called back as a witness, etc. If he, in fact, is victorious in his defense and goes to trial, then the other cases, the defense is going to have to rally. If he's acquitted, then the other the prosecution is going to have to rally and revisit his strategy. And it's what it's done in order to get convictions on the other five because they're going to be in good shape. And they're going to raise all the issues that were raised in the first case, the Porter case, and they're going to inflate those issues with the particular benefit to their clients.
Well, first of all, Dwight Pettit, A, I'm thankful for your legal mind and expertise to be able to come on this show, and I hope that as your schedule allows, with your busy legal work, that you can come in to keep us abreast of
Mark,
your analysis.
Mark, anytime you need me, I'll
really appreciate
always
it.
With you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dwight Pettit, one of our leading defense attorneys in Baltimore City and the country, joins us here for his analysis of what these trials around the death of Freddie Greene might mean. We cover that again next week with some intensity as we see the jury selection later on that next week when we tackle that. And stay with us. We'll be right back. We're going to now tackle in this next hour what's this article that comes out in the city paper really going under, showing how the money was misused and misspent in the housing department. We'll talk about all that means. Stay with us. We'll be right back with our guests. Don't go away. And again, thank you, Dwight.
Mark, always good to see you. Happy year. Thanksgiving also.